So I think the stakes for getting markets right are enormously high when it comes to input markets where you have blinders on.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Research into better seeds, fertilizers, insecticides has the potential to increase agricultural yields across sub-Saharan Africa. But is that potential being realized? We put a lot of attention on how to influence the behavior, the choices that farmers make. But what can policy do to help the sell side, those firms that provide the inputs to the farmers? Hope Michelson of the University of Illinois is one of the authors of a new review of agricultural input markets that finds important gaps in our knowledge. She joins me now. Hope, nice to talk to you again.
It's so nice to see you again. Thanks for having me.
We know that better seeds, fertilizers, pesticides, they exist and they have potential. Why is it, in the broadest terms, that they're not showing up on farms at the right time, the right price? Maybe farmers aren't trusting them.
You're absolutely right that better seeds and fertilizers and pesticides exist. And this adoption challenge has been a persistent question in development economics and in policy. The issue that we've been focusing on for a long time has been the demand side. And we know a lot about the demand side. You know, that poverty, that uninsured risk, that lack of credit creates real problems for farmers who want to buy these things. But the supply side matters too. Part of the objective of writing this paper was to focus some attention on that supply side. Input markets have really expanded and become more integrated over the last two decades in sub-Saharan Africa. Opening of these markets, a change from just parastatal government agencies to a more private sector engagement in these markets. But there's frictions that distort availability and pricing and credibilities. And that's really important for adoption and take up of these interventions. Weak transport, logistics, finance, there are these sharp spatial and seasonal price variations, production risk and seasonality. A lot of the small agri-dealers are credit constrained and poorly insured, but really critical for the functioning of these markets. Timing matters so much. Everybody needs seed at exactly the same time once the rains come. Mm. There's these logistics issues that are just so pressing.
This is something that I rarely end up talking about. Instead, I end up talking a great deal about how farmers and smallholders are behaving and how they achieve those yields, as if those inputs are already there, if they just appear. You argue that our explanations that you tend to use this channel are based on what you call a streetlight effect. Now, explain, what is that?
Sure. This is actually something that Travis Libert, who's a co-author in the paper, really stressed and emphasized as we were writing. And by that, what we mean is that explanations for low agricultural productivity tend to be what you said. We're biased towards what's easiest to observe and measure. And that is to the neglect of other potentially important explanations and mechanisms. So we are really good as development economists at generating insight using household surveys. This has been an incredible methodological tool that we've used, that we've really innovated even in the last 20 years, how we collect that data, how we process that data, how we integrate household survey data with other kinds of surveys. But the focus and our facility with that method can really distort our research priorities because we're implicitly treating the household as the primary relevant unit of analysis. Even, as I said before, as agricultural markets have liberalized and supply chains have become more complex. So those supply side actors that are so important, the agri-dealers, input supply chains, market responses, those are relatively invisible if what we're using are household surveys to do most of our analysis. So that bias can lead us to over-attribute low adoption to exactly what you said, to behaviors at the household level and under-examining whether inputs are actually available, affordable, and responsive to demand. We tend to look where the light is better and that we need to start thinking a little bit more carefully about what the binding constraints might be upstream in agricultural markets.
There is much less research on that. But luckily for you, seeing as you're doing a review, there is not no research on
There's
this
not no
all.
Research. And I do want to emphasize that. That's really important. Summit, yeah, as a market intelligence team that's doing incredible work. All of my co-authors on this piece, Andrew Dillon, Jessica Rutter, Travis Libert, have focused on that. the number of folks at IFPRI. Kyle Emmerich has some work. So there's work. It's exciting work. But our point really is that there's a lot of opportunity in this space.
To give a couple of examples of that work, there was an example from Rwanda, I think, where an intervention worked for the farmers who were treated, but they were hoping that that would spill over to other farmers, but it couldn't because they couldn't get the supplies. I think, is that correct?
That's right. This aspect of the study that you're talking about and that I find so compelling as an example of what we're thinking about, the papers by Esther Duflo and co-authors, and what they find and what they describe in this blog post are what they call negative spillovers on untreated farmers in this Rwanda coffee RCT, where they're trying to increase the use of certain kinds of inputs for coffee production. Training of treated farmers increased demand for scarce inputs, including NPK fertilizer. And that local input supply system, so agri-dealers and cooperatives, was unable to meet that increased demand quickly and efficiently. So from a supply side perspective, what happened was that the agro-input market failed to respond to the increased demand, and that created stockouts and it limited availability. And control farmers who were using that NPK before couldn't get it. The supply side failure creates a market bottleneck, which led to a negative externality for these non-treated farmers. So that negative externality is a consequence of the supply side failure. So we sometimes talk about these kinds of problems as externalities to RCTs, for example, or other kinds of policies. But if you look behind the curtain, if you think about what that mechanism is, another way of talking about it is that there was a failure of the supply side to respond. I can give you another example if you want to hear.
Yes, please do. Yeah.
So this is work that I've done with a team at CIMMYT. That's the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, which is a part of the CJIR research network. And I've been working with some researchers there for several years. So there's a persistent puzzle in East Africa, which is that farmers use old seeds, so not save seeds, but older maize hybrid varieties when newer ones are available in the market. There's a lot of work trying to understand why that is, and it's really interesting and very important work. So we got involved in that work and we implemented a project so that farmers could try out new seeds. So there was sufficient scale in terms of the amount of seed and the number of farmers in a village. And it really worked in terms of increasing demand. So these new hybrids that farmers were trying out in Kenya, they more than doubled the yields that farmers were getting in the year that they tried them out. Big yield effects. Everybody could see them. Lots of talking about those effects in the villages. And then we went back at midline and did a survey. So one season later, and the farmers told us that the yield effects were great, but they couldn't get the seed in the agri-dealer. So they went to the shops to buy it. And we'd been really conscientious about which seed we'd picked. This was a seed that had a lot of promise and was being stocked in agri-dealer shops, but had lower demand than you might expect given its promise. Even given that care with the choice of the seed, the agri-dealers were not stocking it to meet demand, and they weren't sourcing it to meet demand as the farmers were coming into the shop. There's a lot of villages, a lot of farmers. We came back at end line another season later, and the shops still had not responded. So the farmers still couldn't access the seed. So what the farmers had done in many cases is that they had saved the seed from the initial trial packs that we'd given them and replanted it. And if you know about hybrids, you know that reduced hybrid vigor means that you're not going to get the same yield boost in that second planting that you get in the initial one. So the farmers were pretty disappointed by that. And there was a lot of really interesting conversations about why that had happened and why the agri-dealers failed to respond. In that case, there wasn't a negative externality, but we were really surprised, especially given how conscientious we'd been about the seed choice, and we'd worked with agri-dealers to identify the promising seeds. They still had not responded. Those two examples, I think about them a lot. And I wonder which other studies have had attenuated effects in terms of technology adoption in particular. Because, at least in part, the supply side wasn't there. And it's definitely something that I think we need to be paying attention to.
Well, let's have a look at this puzzle then, Hope, from the point of view of the research that you have uncovered in this review and what that tells us. First of all, though, I'd like to know a little bit more about these agri-dealers. How do they work? What is their day like? What do they do?
Agri-dealers, you can think of them as the last mile intermediaries in ag input supply chains. So they're translating, regional and global supply of seeds, fertilizer, pesticides, And they're also dealing with government policy around inputs and what's regulated and what price you can sell things at. And they're translating all that into locally available seed, fertilizer, and chemicals for farmers. They manage inventories across highly seasonal demand. There's a lot of different kinds of agri-dealer operations. Anybody that's worked in this space can tell you sometimes they're seasonal. They just open up around the time of year when farmers need them. Sometimes they're big operations. They've got a lot of employees. Sometimes they're very small. There's a lot of heterogeneity within that sector. Sometimes they provide credit to small farmers. They tend to also provide information to farmers in settings where public extension is weak or absent. So that informational link is really, really important. So the job they do is not just retailing inputs, but they're coordinating logistics, finance, information, and they've got a lot of risk too. Maybe we can talk about that. And these are places where markets are incomplete and unreliable. And it's a critical set of actors if you care about agricultural productivity.
And also the way you describe that, this is not a simple job to do. You need expertise, not just in agriculture, but in logistics as well.
So there's different kinds of operations, right? So you've got some folks that are really tiny little shops, just stocking a few things. And you've got some folks that have pretty sophisticated logistical operations where they're sourcing things directly from the port, renting trucks. So that heterogeneity, I think, is a piece of what we really want to understand better.
Yes, fascinating insights in the paper. I just want to deal with a few of them. First of all, tell me a little bit more about the problems of last mile access.
High travel costs and poor infrastructure and risk raise effective input prices and it can depress adoption, right? So those actors that can get as close to the farmer as possible really play a critical role. What's missing in the literature is an understanding of why these local input markets fail to emerge or persist. So in some places that you have demand, everybody's growing, you know, maize, you've got a lot of folks that are buying inputs, but there's issues associated with provisioning those farmers. So Andrew Dillon, who is the co-author on this piece, he has some really exciting work related to solving demand timing and liquidity such that input markets can function in otherwise underserved rural areas. And that's really important work because currently most policy responses have focused on lowering farmer-side transaction costs. And as I said before, paying less attention to these supply-side frictions. And those supply-side frictions are preventing these last-mile markets from functioning in the first place. Understanding those frictions and understanding how to alleviate them or how to address them may be really critical for understanding where farmers have access and where they're not going to have access to inputs at the right time and the right price.
You already mentioned a little bit about seasonality and the uncertainty that goes with that. We know quite a lot now about how that affects farmers. How does it affect the people that are supplying their inputs as well? Is it in the same way?
Very similar. I'm hesitant to say very similar. Agricultural production is highly seasonal, as you said, and demand for inputs then is also very seasonal. So seed is a great example. Once the rain comes, everybody needs their seed right away, and then they don't really need seed again until the next season.
Yeah.
You have to have your seed then because your market is ready to go, and if you don't, you're not going to sell anything. And if you buy too much, you get stuck holding that extra stock and you can't sell it because it's got a date on it. So there's sort of risks that start kicking in associated with stocking and supply and storage related to that seasonality and understanding what demand you can anticipate. Another thing that I think we don't think about a lot, and some of Jess Rutter's work speaks to this, is that there's a lot of covariate risk when you're dealing with farmers, right? So if you're in an area where you're serving a large number of farmers and they get hit by a really bad year, there's a drought, and nobody has a good harvest that year. They all have had a covariate shock.
Right.
And so what that sometimes can transmit to is a demand shock for you in the next season. Because folks now, what are they going to cut? They're going to cut their fertilizer. They're going to cut back on their pesticides. And so those kinds of covariate risks can aggregate into a kind of a sequential shock that the agri-dealer has to face and risk. And so some of these kinds of dynamics are probably underlying these high entry and exit rates that we're starting to document in agri-dealer networks, at least in Tanzania. Yeah, there's a lot of transaction and stocking risk that sellers hold. So as I said, sellers can't return unsold seed to the distributor. So if you have to understand your market and what the demand is, and that creates risks and costs associated with stocking new products that are really potentially transformative for farmers, but are an unknown quantity for you. So this is something we're thinking about a lot in Kenya, which is why stock a new seed when everybody comes into your shop asking for something that's 15 years old?
Yeah.
What's the incentive for taking a risk on something new? And so we've been focusing for a long time on these demand issues with farmers and trying to figure out, how do we get farmers to demand something new? How do we get them to adopt something new? It may be that the agri-dealers are the ones that we need to be focusing on. And some work by Sarah Kariuki at Summit suggests that that exactly is where we should be working.
There are a lot of entries and exits in this market. What you really want is the companies that survive to be good and to be able to grow. And they need access to finance. If they are good, they need people to understand they are good and to trust them in that way. What are the challenges here?
With reputation and trust, they're huge. I feel like every time you ask me something, I'm like, it's massive. But, and I alluded to this before, but many of the products that these agri-dealers sell are experience goods or even credence goods, right? So experience good, you can't tell what the quality is until you've used it. A credence good, you never know what the quality is. You could debate that in the case of some of these agricultural products, right? So with a pesticide, you spray it on the weed, you can tell pretty immediately whether or not it was effective, right? So that's more of an experience good. With fertilizer, it can be really tricky. And the contributing factor here is the stochasticity of agricultural production. So you have weather intervening all over the place, and it makes detecting that signal from the new input really tricky. So that's hard for farmers then to evaluate and attribute performance. And that means that it's hard for an agri-dealer to establish reputation. So I've done a lot of work on farmer suspicion of fertilizer quality. Mm-hmm. Farmers really worry in East Africa that urea fertilizer is bad quality. We've done more than 1,000 samples of urea tested in labs now. Haven't found a single issue with urea. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but it's not pervasive.
Yeah.
And yet you hear again and again this suspicion of agri-dealers. Agri-dealers are selling old stuff. Agri-dealers are selling stuff that they're mixing with concrete, with pebbles, with salt. And that's really interesting too, because when we talk to agri-dealers, the agri-dealers tell us that they're suspicious of their suppliers, that they think their mm-hmm. suppliers are selling. So even trust and reputation within agri-dealer networks, I think, is really relevant, because that suspicion can add a lot of cost to the way that people are structuring their supply chains and the way that people are trying to mitigate risk, perceived risk, and to sort of address concerns related to reputation. It's just a fascinating area. You enter this and then you start thinking about trust and contracts and reputation and belief. And it's such an important area to work through really fundamental questions related to economics.
So as you say, it's a fascinating area and there is so much potential here. But some of these things that you are attempting to capture, well, it strikes me that they're not easy to measure. Perhaps there is not much data around there at the moment. Is it important to create these panels, these samples of sellers, so that we can really find out more about what they're doing and complement that, match that with what's happening with the farmers?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity here. Having better data in the space would provide new insights. I think it would open up new research questions and new theories. It's hard, but it's really important. Yeah. The first order issue is that we don't have sampling frames to even get started. So if you're going to do this work, you have to solve that problem first. And I'll give you an example. So we were conducting a census of fertilizer sellers in Morogoro, this region in Tanzania, in 2016. Mm-hmm. And so we started, Anna Fairbairn, who's now doing her PhD at the University of Illinois, started off with a list from the government of everybody who had a license, because you're supposed to have a license to sell fertilizer. And we thought, great, we've got it. But let's try to see if we can pick up anybody who maybe got a license since the government list. So we went out, started with that list. There was very, very scant overlap between that list and the number of sellers that she found, which
of
isn't
course, yes.
right. But because there's all these informal folks, there's seasonal people, there's people that had a license and didn't renew it. So that initial step of just figuring out who the actors are and who the population is before you even start your survey and your all these other questions related to the enumeration itself, it's tricky and it's costly and it takes a lot of care.
Yeah. I guess when you have that list, then you also then need to know what they're selling, who they're selling it to, and at what price is essential if we're going to find out what's going on.
Talking to people that have businesses can be tricky, but there's a lot of guidance on how to do that well. I think we can learn from surveys that have been conducted for a while and some of those output market surveys, but there's some amendments and changes that have to happen if you're thinking about inputs.
I'm understanding why this is hard for you now. But I mean, also talking about trust, very important, very difficult to measure. Quality, again, very important, very difficult to measure as well. But I guess we have to capture this as well in the data.
I think you do. Yeah, I think you do. You want to figure out what the question is and then design your data collection efforts really targeted towards that question. But I suppose at this stage, it feels like there's a lot to know, even just descriptively.
Yeah.
So I think those initial survey efforts could make a pretty significant contribution just by careful characterization of some of these dynamics that you're describing.
Yeah, if we started tomorrow to do this, I'm glad I'm not starting tomorrow to do this because it sounds like very, very hard work. But for those of you who are experts in it, what's the first step?
So working with firms, there's some really interesting options out there. Uh-huh. One thing that Zimit has done, they've secured access to 3 years of daily transaction data that's organized by agri-dealer, by product, and it was collected by a private firm
for
market research.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Some of these data products exist because it's firms collecting data to sell to other firms. And I think as markets are developing in sub-Saharan Africa, and they're developing quickly in some places, maybe those kinds of data products would be useful for the kinds of questions that we're trying to ask. Just that data alone that Simit has secured has been really incredible. As a PhD student I work with, Hannah Woolworth, she's studying how agri-dealer stocking responses, so how they change their stocking portfolio based on weather forecasts from the Kenyan government. That's really interesting because we worry a lot about climate adaptation and we think a lot about how our farmers adapting. But farmers can't adapt if they can't access the products in the first place. So being able to understand, look, how are agri-dealers with all of these risks and challenges that they face in their operations, how are they responding to climate forecasts? It just tells us a new part of the story. It gives us new questions and it gives us new ways of looking at those questions. So maybe there's some interesting ways that we can use. You know, Nielsen has all this firm data, right? They have really cool data. Maybe we can start being a little bit more creative about this. Because I worry we're going into a period where there's less resources now available for data in the development space. And some of the kind of workhorse data sources that we've had for a long time, like the LSMS and the DHS, they're in jeopardy.
Over the years, I've done a reasonable amount of work looking at retail markets in high-income countries. Uh-huh. And I know that this is a problem that supermarkets and their suppliers have put a lot of resource into trying to solve, and it's extremely difficult for them to solve with all the resources that they have.
Think about small retailers with less access to credit and much more complex and fragmented markets. How are they solving similar kinds of problems? I think we really need to understand that. So I agree.
If we do understand it, though, Hope, what is the prize here? What is there to gain?
There's some exciting and I think really worrying research that's come out recently by authors that include Chris Udry, Doug Gollan, Philip Wolberg. And they're documenting declining agricultural yields in sub-Saharan Africa. That's really important. Uh-huh. This challenge is significant. And the population increases in sub-Saharan Africa relative to the rest of the world only increase the importance of that challenge of declining yields. So I think the stakes for getting markets right are enormously high when it comes to input markets. We have blinders on. We need to close the gaps in the knowledge we have about input markets, about pricing, about last mile access. We have to have this so that we can diagnose whether those kinds of yield declines reflect worsening constraints or market failures. Acting on that knowledge could unlock, I think, really significant productivity gains, help us understand why these yield declines are happening, and help address them. This is really critical for poverty. It's really critical for food security. And it's an essential piece of policy and also of research that we're doing.
I wish you luck with it. Hope, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
The article, if you want to look for it, is published in the Annual Review of Resource Economics. It is called Agricultural Input Markets in Sub-Saharan Africa, Theory and Evidence from the Underappreciated Supply Side. Authors Andrew Dillon, Travis Libbert, Hope Michelson and Jessica Rudder. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, you can join in with this by now, is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where there are articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a good review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.